hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life by fighting in the fog of dying. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a part of God's. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fog that I keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, so much to look at today, and one of the front page story in the National Post today, and write up that really resonates with me, and that is it's a write-up of about the Toronto District School Board. And, you know, these are massive bureaucracies. In fact, several reports have found that the one at the in Toronto is a huge Board of Education. It is, in many cases, dysfunctional. And it's very left-wing. Anyway, Christy Blatchford writes, if there were any doubt, there is no more. Canada is the stupidest country ever. The evidence already all around is now irrefutable. The Toronto District School Board, in its effort to remain ahead of the Ontario government's curve on all gender, cultural, political sensitivities, is not only contenting itself with following the Negro Education Minister Mitzi Hunter's directive of earlier this year to review all potentially Indigenous offensive team names and mascots. You know, and so in other words, no more, you know, the Braves or the Indians. But now they love to do this, the politically correct changing the language. And you just have to wonder. Okay, this she says, I can confirm the title chief is being phased out in various departments of the Toronto District School Board. Board spokesman Ryan Bird, and it's for the birds, told the National Post. It's part of an ongoing work that the school board does through the TDSB, Aboriginal Education Center, with regards to Truth and Reconciliation Commission and its massive final report of 2015. Now, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a commission dominated by Indians that looked into the residential schools and put forth all sorts of recommendations and so on. Well, amazing, isn't it? So now the title of all that gobbledygook, and you wonder, what does that cost the taxpayers? The Toronto District School Board's Aboriginal Education Center. Why don't they get the same education as everybody else? Well, apparently some key titles at the board were changed a few years ago, such as Chief Financial Officer. Among the most recent casualties is the sign on the door of the office of Chief Caretaker Karen Griffith at Glenview Public School in the city's affluent North End. Last week, staff noticed that the word chief had been blacked out on the door. Well, you know, what could possibly be offensive about that? It doesn't even say the person's a chief. It just says they are the foremost, like the chief financial officer is the head of the finance department. The chief caretaker or custodian, I guess they call them today, at a school is, there are probably several, this is the boss. But why would chief be offensive? And you know, part of this comes down to constantly changing things. And that has an effect. And I saw that when I was in education myself. It destabilizes people. Now, somewhere between mindless complacency and changing things all the time, there's a happy medium. Yes, as new ideas or new concepts come along, yes, it's got to be a change of name or a new name. But there's a tradition is also important. You know, it gives us some predictability in our life. For instance, one of the reasons in just setting a table, there's a prescribed position for the knives and the forks. And almost any reasonable place in Western society will have the fork on the left, or forks, and the knife and the spoon on the right. There's a predictability to that. And that's what's being sacrificed here. Now, it's not even clear that any Indians ever asked for that. But chief is not derogatory. In fact, in referring to Indians, it simply means the head of a tribe. It has also frequently been the way we designate the boss, and there's nothing derogatory about that. This constant self-abasement and changing things to somehow mollify or placate other groups' feelings, and I emphasize, there's no indication that that the Indians even asked for that. And I understand it was not even one of the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Not that we should have to be bound by that either. This is taking minority-itis to the absolute ultimate. It's also another example of what's sometimes called virtue signaling. You show how good you are by how much you debase yourself. Well, front page of today's paper, and this is a story. I don't want to go into it in great detail, but Harvey Weinstein, he is the head of Miramax, and also the more recently the Harvey Weinstein, the Weinstein company, has now been accused by a number of Hollywood actresses of rape or very improper come-ons, among them model and actress Ozzie Argento, Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, Mira Scorvino. Argento and Scorvino, I believe, said he raped them. The other said he tried to fondle them. Rosanna Arquette, Ambra Battaliano Gutierrez, Rose McGowan, Ashley Judd. Apparently, not to put too fine a point on it, Harvey Weinstein was a gross pig. Would frequently try to get these actresses, especially when they were young, and aspiring, obviously in a position where, you know, he could exert some blackmail over them or control. You know, the implication was, if you want to get ahead, and he made that point to at least one actress, that's another actress who'd be, quote, good to him, and her career had shot ahead. Anyway, just disgusting, pathetic behavior. Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie have come forward to allege that Harvey Weinstein, the disgraced movie mogul, sexually harassed them when they were young actresses. The 65-year-old film producer was also accused of rape and sexual assault by three other women in an exclusive in the New York Times. The new allegations mark a shocking escalation of the scandal that has engulfed Hollywood. Both Paltrow and Jolie described how the producer, who was instrumental in launching Paltrow's career, made unwanted advances toward them in hotel rooms. Five other women went on to record alleged sexual assault or harassment. Weinstein denied claims by actresses Rosanna Arquette and Mira Scorvino that he damaged their careers after they rejected his advances. Yes, Scorvino actually had, I don't think he had raped her. The New Yorker also published an audio tape, apparently of a conversation between Weinstein and an Italian model from 2015, in which it seems he is heard confessing some form of sexual assault. And then this goes back many years, and it's a pattern of behavior that obviously continues right to the present. The incident with Paltrow would be back about 20 years ago. In an article in the New York Times, Asia Argento, an Italian actress best known for her role in the action film XXX, and a former aspiring actress named Lucia Evans, went on record to allege Weinstein forced himself on them. A third woman also said he'd raped them. Rosanna Arquette, meanwhile, claimed that in the early 1990s, she went to pick up a script at the Beverly Hills Hotel, arriving at Weinstein's room to find him in a bathrobe and asking for a massage. She claimed he'd then tried to forcibly initiate a sexual encounter, and when she refused, named another actress who had advanced her career that way. And, of course, disgusting as this is, it's nothing new. While there are certainly European men who take advantage of women, the role of Jewish producers in Hollywood going way back into the 20s was notorious. In fact, the term the casting couch meant that an actress would come in seeking a job or for an audition, and she'd be told, it would be suggested in not very subtle terms, that if she wanted a favorable response, she should get on the couch and, you know, perform a sexual act or several. Weinstein is of interest, not only because apparently his behavior was widely known. This wasn't one actress who came forth and nobody else knew about it. In fact, Angelina Jolie apparently told other young actresses to be very careful of Weinstein, that he was notorious for forcing himself on people. This fat, pudgy, not very attractive man. Well, he has now been fired by his own company. Somehow, although there's no criminal charges yet, somehow manages to flee the country. He's now in Europe, allegedly taking rehab, which sounds good, but you wonder just what's happening. His wife has left him. But almost, it's interesting to see the utter sleaze of Hollywood. But it's also fascinating because Weinstein was a huge contributor to the to left-wing Democratic causes, including women's causes. He was a major backer of both Obama and Hillary Clinton, and it took the Clintons 5 days after this scandal broke last week to finally put out a statement deploring it and denouncing it. And you wonder if they would not have known, because people like the Clintons and the Obamas were thick with the Hollywood crowd. You know, it wasn't just that this Weinstein put a check in the mail and sent it to them. They attended posh parties together. I believe Weinstein even vacationed at the New England summer residence of the Clintons. I believe that was true. So, and he was a major funder of many left-wing Democrats. I think they've got some splaining to do. And this just furthers the image of the utter sleaze of Hollywood. The garbage that is spewed out of Hollywood is perhaps not accidental. I'm no prude, and I don't personally disapprove of violence or sex in movies. However, I think you can make a strong case that many of the Hollywood productions are disgusting, and promote. It's one thing to expose or to show evil behavior, but to promote it, to hold it forth as good, is, I think, a persistent critique of what's funneled out from Hollywood, in the past several decades. There is an exhibit at a university in Pennsylvania that is causing some concern, so to speak. And this is an exhibit about the South, the Ku Klux Klan, and so on, lynchings, and it certainly doesn't sound like a very the sort of exhibit you or I would want to see. Anyway, the university that's hosting it is so concerned about how traumatic it is and how feelings could be hurt or damaged that they've actually said that attendance will be restricted to university students or members of the university for fear perhaps it's just too heavy for other people. One of the things that is really disappointing about our age today is the way that universities and educational institutions feel they have to create safe spaces for people. A university should not be safe. It should be a place where there's vigorous discussion, where people are perhaps made to feel just a little bit, uneasy. Never thought of that. Well, this is a little different. That's what a university should do. A university should challenge people. Anyway, Canada has produced, I'm not surprised. It's immigration, stupid. Oh, before I do that, the province of Alberta is to offer Arabic bilingual program this fall. That's at the high school level. No, elementary too. The Alberta government will be offering an Arabic language curriculum across the province next year. Alberta Education is working to develop the bilingual program with Edmonton Public Schools, one of a few districts in the province that provides the option. The Edmonton Public Board says Arabic is the fastest growing language program, well, in Alberta, because there's so many Muslim immigrants. The province contracted the Edmonton Board last year to help develop a modified version. The program for students in kindergarten through grade 12 will be available starting in September, said Education Minister David Egan. The government recognizes the economic and academic benefits of proficiency in more than one language. We are thrilled to be moving toward a curriculum in our commitment to develop the province's Arabic language arts K-12 curriculum by September 2015. Well, as a teacher and as a linguist, I would agree. Learning languages is a good idea. Whether the big emphasis should be on Arabic, I don't agree. If you want to place your bets, I would say Chinese. And I have no problem with people learning another language. I just wonder, though, if there's another agenda here. As an educator, I've got to say it's pretty light on detail. Portrait of a Terrorist. Yep. And, you know, you figure this guy is only 19. He came from Kuwait to Canada. He seems to be a loner and a loser. And what's he been doing with his time? Well, ensconced at home on the internet, he was conspiring with a Pakistani and a Filipino to do major mayhem in New York City. But it wasn't just talk. They were taking direct action to begin to assemble the necessary explosives. And then they got into conversations, emails with a supposed supporter, an ISIS supporter, who turned out to be an FBI agent. Anyway, all three are nicked, but it's a very interesting portrait. Very interesting portrait indeed. I'll get to that right now. And by his own lawyer's account, Abdul El Banasawi led a sheltered existence in Mississauga. Hey, that's my community. They're all among us. This is the problem. People will say, well, you, not all Muslims do that, but this guy and his confederates were planning acts of terrorism, terrible acts of terrorism for New York City. They wanted to be the biggest bang that there's been, to outdo what happened at the World Trade Center. The Twin Towers. They do this in the name of their religion. ISIS does what it does. Its terrorist attacks are undertaken in the name of religion. So we have every reason to be we have every reason to be worried about that. I think we have every reason to want to scrutinize Muslims, assuming there are good guys, or let's say guys that are not committed to violence. How do you separate them? And I don't think being questioning Islam is at all wrong. In fact, it makes perfect sense to me that this is what we ought to be doing. There should be no free ride. Anyway, the story goes on. Suffering from serious mental health problems, the teenager's world revolved around his parents, his older sister, and the people he met while being treated for an opioid disorder, and was a drug addict. in high school. He never got past grade 11. Now, the kid's now 19. So, you know, he's a loser. But that's not an excuse. He has no friends outside of his close-knit family, said the attorneys last year. Now that's his own lawyers who are going to put the best spin they can on it. He has no friends outside his immediate family. But for months online, Al-Banasawi led a much different life, claiming allegiance to the Islamic State and concocting an elaborate and bloody plot to attack the subway system, concerts, and other public areas in New York City. It was a plan sketched out in part on subway maps he hoped would rival 9/11 and lead to a glorious death to please Allah. You see, it's for religious reasons. Now, what Al-Banasawi did not know is that one of the co-conspirators he plotted with by internet was actually an undercover FBI agent. When the Canadian entered the U.S. to build a bomb, accompanied by his parents and sister on a family vacation, he hoped to use as a front. And, you know, I don't think the kid's stupid. You know, it doesn't sound like retarded to me. He was arrested. Well, he was then 18. With his court file unsealed this past Friday, after 18 months of secrecy, a portrait began to emerge of a young, troubled, and unlikely terror mastermind from Mississauga, which is a suburb of Toronto. And, quote, "Let's just shoot up concerts because they kill a lot of people," Al-Banasawi suggested. "Times Square is also good. Car bomb there," he said, "would be good." Within 5 months of his arrest, the immigrant from Kuwait had pleaded guilty. So he pleaded guilty to this. It's not a matter that they got the wrong man or he claims it wasn't what they thought. He's pleaded guilty to terrorist plotting, which will probably cost him pretty close to his life in prison. But in letters and court appearances aimed at getting Al-Banasawi out of segregation at New York's Metropolitan Correction Center, lawyer Sabrina Schroff painted her client as a mentally fragile and deteriorating. Well, boo-hoo-hoo. Al-Banasawi, now 19, indicated in an email to a New York lawyer last month that he wanted to fire his current lawyers and get a Canadian lawyer who had worked for another terrorist, Omar Khadr. Al-Banasawi was born in Kuwait, but lived most of his life in Canada, where he had citizenship. He returned to Kuwait for grades 9 and 10, then came back here, he told court. He was arrested May 21st, 2016, in front of his family, the culmination of an undercover operation that also involved a suspect from Pakistan, an American citizen, and one in the Philippines. The other men are now in custody in those countries. So there's a conspirator in Pakistan, a conspirator in the Philippines. In pleading guilty to seven crimes in October 2016, Al-Banasawi admitted to conspiring to bomb Times Square, attack passengers on the subway, and shoot up concerts shoot up crowds at unarmed concerts. Unnamed concerts. He was to join forces with the American who was living in Pakistan, another 18-year-old trying to raise enough money for an air ticket to New York. At one point that spring, the Canadian ordered 40 pounds of hydrogen peroxide, an ingredient in the explosive TATP, and had it delivered to the undercover agent. He also arranged to rent a cabin in New Jersey where a bomb could be assembled. And he said, and this is kind of frightening, don't forget, his plan is to do it for Islam. These Americans need an attack, and we can't delay or cancel, he said to the person he thought was a fellow ISIS supporter. this, I think, should be used at every opportunity to try to smack down those who yammer on about Islamophobia. You would be a fool not to have a certain fear of the followers of a religion who are prepared to create such mayhem. How did he put it? So that is this to bring him a glorious death to please Allah. See, he's not worried about his own life. And you know, this is the sort of thing we have to be very clear about. We have to tax the Muslims in our midst. Look, this is on you. These are your people doing this in the name of your religion. Now there are people say, oh, well, they don't have the right, yeah, they have the wrong interpretation of the religion. That may be. But it's not up to me, you and me, to work it out. This really raises the question of why we would bring people like this to our country. Now, why take the risk? And you know, this sounds amateurish. And no, the FBI did intervene and stop it, but it could have gone wrong. All they needed to have done was to be able to make one bomb, and the one bomb could have killed a lot of people. And as he noted, Times Square is often full of people, target rich. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm back in just a couple of minutes, but I'm going to play a couple of songs for my musical interlude. These are the first two are by Rebel Sun. He's a I think a dynamic singer and songwriter. And this one is Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee. Rebel Sun.
In my old Chevy riding through the Sound, I looked up on the hill and I saw a big white house. I caught a glimpse of a bearded man polishing his sword. Well, I saw Robert E. Lee outside sitting on the porch. I pulled up in the yard and saw a cotton field out back. He invited me to sit with him and share a fifth of Jack. He had crisscross bars and 13 stars blowing. He said, save your Confederate money, boy, cause the South will rise again. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie, how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. We talked about his troops and the rebel infantry and us 13 southern states that live in infamy. As he took another swig of his black label whiskey, he said, that Yankee pride don't mean a damn thing to me. He spoke about his men and how they always fought so brave, and how they wove their sacred flag on any life they gave. He struggled to gain independence for his southern ground. He stood up for his cause and never wants to be back down. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. Thank you.
It was 2 o'clock a.m. and the fire was getting low. So I thanked him for our talk, cause it was time for me to go. While walking to my car, I turned to thank him once again. But the light was bare, there was nothing there but rocks and dirt and sand. Was it my imagination playing with my head? I remember hearing clearly every single word he said. Every movement, every gesture, every tear that his heart shed. His dream is still alive, even though his body's dead. Robert E. Lee's memory lives on in the Southern soul, along with his boys who fought and died out in the cold. Lee was a man with tons of courage, a hero without a doubt. He was a man with determination, he was a man from the South. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. He said, son, I've got many stories to tell. Ulysses S. Grant, kiss my ass and go to hell. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. And I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. Drink him up, bro.
That's Rebel Son, sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. I'm going to play another one by Rebel Son. This is a Mr. Confederate Man. It's a really touching ballad. A ballad about pride.
I was just a little boy in elementary school. English and math and science class, learning the golden rule. I learned how to add and how to subtract, how to multiply and divide. I learned about bugs and I learned about plants and I learned how to read and write. But my most favorite class of all was my last class of the day, when my history teacher would tell us tales of old times long gone away. I was amazed at the way she knew all the people and their names and the places and the dates. That's when I first learned about General Lee and his 13 rebel states. One day she came to school with a big brown grocery bag. She opened it up, we all helped her hold up this great big egg-shaped flag. She said, class, now only a fool will tell you this flag is a symbol of hate. It represents the men who fought and died with pride for our Confederate states. Your assignment tonight, I want you to write, I want you to pretend that one of these brave men came back to life. Now what would you say to him? Well, the school bell rang and I thought, as the bus carried me across town, I got out my pencil and my notebook pad, and this is what I wrote down. I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. day in history class, I put my paper on the teacher's desk. Then she called me up in front of everyone, because she said she liked mine the best. As I walked up to the head of the class, my teacher smiled and she nodded at me. Then I saw a tear roll down her cheek as I began to read. I read, "Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man." At home reading through the news just the other day, when I ran across my old teacher's name and I saw where she had passed away. With a bittersweet smile I looked up at my wall, a wrinkled paper in an old wood frame, where underneath pencil words almost faded away, she had marked a great big red A. Plus, "Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man." I wrote, "Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man."
That's Mr. Confederate Man, and that's Rebel Sun. Hope you like that. I'll play one more tune here on our musical interlude today. Well, actually, we have already played that, so I'm going to play, this is a nice gospel song. It was made quite famous in the mid-1970s by Johnny and June Carter Cash. This is Jimmy Fortune's version of "The Far Side Banks of Jordan."
I believe my steps are growing wearier each day. Still I've got a journey on my mind. Lures of this old world have ceased to make me want to stay. And my one regret is leaving you behind. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout. Come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. If it proves to be his will that I am first to cross, somehow I'll be feeling it will be. When it comes your time to travel, likewise don't feel lost. For I will be the first one that you'll see. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout. And come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. Through this life we've labored hard, to earn our meager fare. It's brought us trembling hands and failing eyes. So I'll just rest here on this shore and turn my eyes away. Until you come, then we'll see paradise. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand.
That's Jimmy Fortune and Far Side Banks of Jordan. I hope you like it for our little musical break tonight. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots of reasons for resistance. Wow, it is a crazy time here. One of the things I've worried about is that foreigners come to Canada and then tell us what flags we can fly. I warned way back in the early 1990s, a number of talks that I gave across this great dominion, and also a talk I gave to the one of the first public meetings of a group called the Heritage Front. I warned that multiculturalism was going to cost us important rights, particularly freedom of speech. Multiculturalism is a policy that can only be implemented and enforced by repression. Doesn't work. Show me one country in the world where people of various cultures in any significant numbers get along swimmingly. Well, doesn't happen. The only way it can be brought about is through force. And one of the ways to force, one of the means of force, is restrictions on free speech. I warned about that. Well, that got me into a lot of trouble. My then employer, the Peel District School Board, call that unacceptable. In fact, if I was to say that type of thing again, or certain other things I'd said, it could lead to my firing. Well, eventually, I was fired after a 25-year career in education, not for anything I ever did wrong in the classroom or with students, but for my political opinions expressed on my own time, on my own dime, off school property. Well, those were. That was one of them. Anyway, I wish I'd been wrong, but unfortunately I'm not. Last summer, a immigrant named Yibia, Y-B-I-A, Anderson, probably from Africa, attended a festival. There was a Dukes of Hazzard display. This is part of the Highland Creek Village Festival. It's annually held on city land in the Highland Village Creek community in the far east end of Scarborough, which is in the east end of Toronto. The news report says Ibia Anderson was visiting the festival with her son. Hello? She's visiting with her son. And Now, this is what happened. There was a replica of General Lee, which was the car made famous by the Dukes of Hazzard. Jimmy Anderson was visiting the festival with her three-year-old son, and she noticed a replica of General Lee, the customized Dodge Charger from the U.S. TV show Dukes of Hazzard. The vehicle was displaying two Confederate flags, one on its roof and the other on its bumper. Despite her objections, the organizers refused to move the car. In a tape she recorded of the incident, Anderson can be heard demanding that the person in charge of the car remove it, which he refuses to do. "Let me tell you what I want. I want the car gone. I want it out of sight. It does not belong here. It represents lynching and death of black people. This is racist. This does not belong here." An uppity foreigner coming here and telling us what we can and cannot have this car. And the I don't know if she means the car or the flag was about lynching black people. It had nothing to do with that. It was the war between the states. It was a war about slavery and other things as well. And I think I may have this. Perhaps not. She wants the car gone. What gives her the right? You know, if she doesn't want to see it or she doesn't want her son to see it, fair enough. No problem. Just walk away. Why does the world have to be changed around for these newcomers? Well, the story, if anything, gets even better. Toronto Council, City Council, is set to discuss a call for a ban this week on the Confederate battle flag in public places, stemming from a raucous confrontation during a festival this past summer. Councillor Nathan Shan of Ward 42, which is in the far east end of the city, has introduced a motion that aims to clarify what symbols can be displayed during events in parks and other public spaces. He's calling for an outright ban on the Confederate flag, in particular from city-owned spaces and city-sponsored events. I think at some point we have to put our foot down and say what is not acceptable when it comes to symbols of hate. It's very interesting that he's a Tamil, you see. And the Tamils, of course, in Canada, many of them supported the Tamil Tigers, and they were a vicious terrorist group. In fact, there were big protests in Toronto just before the war between the government of Ceylon and the Tamil Tigers ended. A big demonstrations, including one that blocked a number of city streets. I don't know the old country politics of this Councillor Shan, but would he be interested in having the flag of the Tamil Tigers banned? He said this is not a case of freedom of expression or freedom of speech. Is a symbol of hate that infringes on the well-being of other people in a place that is public, in a place that is publicly funded, in a place that is publicly maintained or supported by the community. Well, there's the important word, public. And people who like the flag are also members of the public. And their symbol should not be taken down. It is a case of freedom of expression, freedom of speech. It doesn't infringe on anybody's well-being. If you don't like it, don't look at it. If you don't like it, walk away. Why does the answer to everything have to be, shut up? Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, played by the 48th Highlanders of Canada. Thank you.